The whole little society entered into this laudable design, according to their different abilities. Their little plot of land produced plentiful crops. Cunegonde was, indeed, very ugly, but she became an excellent pastry cook. Paquette worked at embroidery. The old woman looked after the linen. They were all, not excepting Friar Giroflée, of some service or other, for he made a good joiner, and became a very honest man. Pangloss sometimes said to Candide, "There is a concatenation of events in this best of all possible worlds, for if you had not been kicked out of a magnificent castle for love of Miss Cunegonde, if you had not been put into the Inquisition, if you had not walked over America, if you had not stabbed the Baron, if you had not lost all your sheep from the fine country of El Dorado, you would not be here, eating preserved citrons and pistachio nuts." "All that is very well," answered Candide, "but let us cultivate our garden."
This is the explosive story of the Karamazov family. The seed of depravity and sin that was in their father was the only thing the brothers had in common.
Welcome back to The Reader's Karamazov. We are your hosts, the Bastard Sons of Hegel.
I'm Carl Bookmarks.
I'm Friedrich Pietsche.
And I'm Soren Rearguard. We're happy to have you back. Thanks for those of you who have been listening to Season 2. We just wrapped up the first part of our season, The Long March, where we were reading through George Eliot's Middlemarch. We did 4 episodes on that. You can catch up with those if you haven't heard them already. You can do that. You can go to our Podbean, thereaderskaramazov.podbean.com. You can listen to us on Apple, on Spotify. And you can follow us on social media if you want to know more. We're on Twitter at TheReadersK. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/TheReadersKaramazov. And if you have any questions or comments, feel free to send them our way at TheReadersKaramazov@gmail.com. One other thing we want to let you know about, those of you who have been longtime listeners, you know that at the end of the episode, we have Cat Keyboard play us out, and then we have a little bit of a bonus content usually for you. We actually have a little bit more than usual bonus content this time around. We've got the debut of a brand new segment here on The Reader's Karamazov that we're calling Postmodern Food Factory. So we hope you'll join us for that after the end of the episode proper. It's a good one. We're going to be trying something absolutely delicious and talking about it. So join us for that. We're really happy to be moving into this new section of our season as we start to unpack resonances between our other books of the season and Middlemarch itself, along with just taking the books as they are. We're starting with a great pick. This is Carl's pick, which is Voltaire's Candide. And this is starting off our section that we're calling The Key to All Mythologies. And so we've tied this into, of course, the character of Casaubon from Middlemarch, who is trying to devise a key to all mythologies. This section is very much looking at books that are interested in somehow in totality, in making a measure of all things. And that's certainly true of tonight's book. We're going to start, as always, with a plot summary. And I'll warn you, listeners, if you haven't read Candide, that this is going to be very bare bones. This is about an 80-page, in my edition, it's about 80 pages. So 1/10 the size of Middlemarch, but it has, I think, maybe twice the plot of Middlemarch. It's a lot going on. We're going to talk about that in a second, the way that this book operates. But it's a very plot-heavy book because it's full of incident. So I'm not going to tell you everything that happens in the book, but I'm going to give you a general overview of the direction of the book. So Candide is a sort of a satire of the 18th century life, and it stars the title character Candide, who is a young man who's being raised up in a baron's castle in Germany. He gets kicked out of the castle, away from his lady love Cunegonde, the daughter of the baron. And that sets off a series of misadventures throughout Europe and throughout South America, and eventually into sort of Turkey and the Middle East, that take us through the rest of the book. And over the course of the book, basically one bad thing after another happens to Candide. He keeps getting beat up, he keeps losing all of his stuff. He keeps reuniting with people he thinks he's lost and then being torn apart from them again. But basically, what's happening is he's going through the world and discovering that what he thought was true about the world, what his teacher, Dr. Pangloss, had taught him, which is that this is the best of all possible worlds. Things always sort of work out. he learns maybe is not so true as he gets repeatedly abused by people, kicked to the ground. And Voltaire basically leads us through a series of set pieces where Candide is meeting new people and things don't go as planned. But he does along the way pick up some faithful friends. So the characters who sort of stay with us throughout the book, aside from Candide, Dr. Pangloss is there talking about the way the world works and how wonderful it is. Cunegonde keeps coming and showing up and then leaving again. There is an old woman who eventually accompanies them who's had a terrible life, and she tells us all about her. She only has one buttocks, so sort of her defining feature. And then there's some other characters. There's a kind of important character who comes near the end whose name is Martin, and he's sort of the anti-Pangloss. He's very depressed all the time, sort of an Eeyore character, right? He thinks everything is terrible. There's Cacambo, Candide's loyal servant who helps him through many a jam. And eventually what happens is all these characters sort of meet back up near Constantinople. And what they decide in the end, they've lost all their riches and all their status, and they end up just sort of living together in a communal state and farming in their garden. And that's the end of the book. They've gone through all these misadventures. They've met royalty. They've met all these important people. But in the end, they're just living a simple life working in their garden. Those are the basics of the plot. We're going to talk through things a little bit as we go and some of the incidents that he comes across. But much more than that happens, but it's hard to follow. So just read it and get a sense of where it's going. I thought that would actually be a good place to start as we talk about it is just the mode in which this book operates, which is very different than we might think about when we think about how a novel is supposed to work. And it's worth pointing out, right, that Voltaire is writing in the 18th century, very early on in the life of the Western novel, have been around about 150 years at this point, and we're well before the full flowering of what we would call maybe realism in the 19th century. And because of that, the book operates in some very strange ways, and it is essentially what we would call a picaresque novel. And what that means is there's not really a through plot. There's not one plot that we're working towards our end. It's very incident-based. So something happens, and then another thing happens, and then another thing happens, and then another thing happens. Because of that, it also relies heavily on stock characterization, so there's not the characters, you know, when you read it are very different than characters we would encounter today. They're not fully fleshed out, and they're not supposed to be. They're supposed to represent some type or idea, right, or way of being in the world, and do that very bluntly in many ways. And so there's a sort of jarringness to reading this book if we're trained in the world of deeply realized characters and plots that have some sort of wonderful arc to them and then resolve. Things just sort of happen, and then the next thing happens, and then the next thing happens, and then we reach an end point at the end. It's sort of a resolution, but it's also just sort of here's the final thing. I mean, what do you all think about picaresque as a mode of storytelling? I'm a very big fan of it, but I know a lot of people don't like it as much, and it's maybe hard for people to get into.
Yeah, I think it has lost its popularity in the present in a lot of ways. I think caricatured depictions have, for many good reasons, you know, fallen by the wayside, but a sort of zany cartoon world is kind of what it can feel like to us in the present. And, you know, it's like, it's a bit like Looney Tunes, like, you know, a character sort of falls off a cliff and then in the next scene, they're there again. Soren did a great job trying to summarize the book, which is just all plot. I mean, that's part of what makes it kind of a picaresque too, is each chapter is just, and this is what happened. And it's almost all summary. There's not tons of scenes fleshing out what's happening in a, giving us a beautiful picture of how the characters are interacting. It's like, and then they went here and then they did this, or a character recounts how they did it. I think it's, you know, why not both? Why can't we have some very realistic depictions and we get a lot of psychological depth and interiority of characters and they seem very real to us? And then a sort of a world where all of that is sidelined and we're interested in kind of a non-real, anti-real space where ideas are playing out, an argument is being made in a different kind of way. It kind of touches different aspects of your, you know, readerly mind. So I really like that.
Yeah, I agree with what Carl's saying about what each chapter is doing, that there's like a presentation of multiple types, as Soren said, and ideas being let out to play, and then a sort of ironic denouement at the end of each one in which those ideas are sort of punctured or overturned in some way. And maybe some sort of knowledge that we think Candide has come to claim is revealed as foolishness. I think the picaresque has its joys, and that's one of them. It's able to play with a lot of different ideas. Voltaire was a contemporary of Defoe, who wrote Moll Flanders, a great picaresque to different effect. And I think we have to remember, too, that like its much older Don Quixote, it's a satire of a romance as well. A person on a journey seeking the love of a fair maiden. And in each of those, the satire is pointed at different people or different genres or bodies of thought or whatever.
I think I'd like to make the argument that this book in particular, its concerns and its preoccupations are actually quite well suited for the picaresque because it is in many ways, we're stashing it in this section on totality, but it's a very anti-totality book, right? The viewpoint of the book is that totality is not really possible. And so I think that the picaresque mode works there because it's kind of grinding against the grain of realism, which is trying to give you everything. It's trying to give you a completeness, a complete sense of characters, and some sort of completed arc, right? Even if it's not a complete life, most realism isn't, right? It's a completed segment of a life or something.
In a world that makes sense.
In a world that makes sense, absolutely, right? And this is sort of saying, like, people maybe, we like to think of ourselves as somehow coherent and complete beings, but maybe we're not. Maybe we're just this like weird bundle of different things, right? And we just keep popping back up in other people's stories in ways that don't really make sense, but are somehow true to life. So I think there's that element of, I don't know if it's quite randomness or chance, but it's an element of unpredictability about the way that human beings behave. Even while I know they're stock characters somewhat, but they have a sense of like their lives just not progressing along a particular arc, but just sort of flip-flopping everywhere.
It's what John Fowles in his novels calls hazard. He always returns to this idea of hazard. And since we've talked about Fowles in the past, I wanted to go to Iris Murdoch because, of course, we tend to go back to her too. But yeah, there's this idea that what's driving this, I mean, for Fowles, it's someone who is like a central character with a will that's being psychologically defined. What drives them is, in fact, not what they think. It's being upended in some way. And I think Soren's right to say that we're not even thinking Candide is driving this. He's being tossed about everywhere in every chapter, right? And he thinks he's driving towards something, and then he's pushed away to the next adventure. And then like 30 chapters in, he finally ends up where he thinks he's going to, and it's not where he thought he was going to.
I guess I saw the book a little bit differently in the sense that I agree with what Soren is saying, that there's haphazardness. But I mean, I would also place this in the subgenre of Menippean satire. It's clearly a satire against a idea or a philosophy or a theodicy of Leibniz, and less so about a culture or a person. But I think that that haphazardness has to be baked in order to ridicule the idea that is up for, you know, being flensed throughout the whole book, which is that this is the best of all possible worlds. This is what Pangloss teaches. And Pangloss is hanged at an auto de fe, but then we learn later that he survived it. But I think he has one eye at the end, right? And he's lived a life of terrible pain, and he's been tortured and humiliated throughout the book. The joke always being, but nevertheless, he's convinced of his own philosophy that this is the best of all possible worlds. So at the end of Candide, I will counter Soren's point that this is haphazardly done. I think the end of the book is a clear moral, in fact, as to what the book means on Voltaire's part. And in a sort of anti-Panglossian but pro-Cassobanian way, I will suggest that there is a totality being offered at the end. So we have different characters who render for us different ideas about, as they say at the end, these arguments over metaphysics and morals that are taking place in continental philosophy at this time. So we have Candide, Cunegonde, Pangloss, Martin, Cacambo, and the old woman. And what happens to each of them is that Cacambo and the old woman have worn themselves out with toil, essentially. as has Kunigunda for him. And so to have worked too much is one way to live one's life and a bad outcome. And then opposing Candide on either side, there is Pangloss, who essentially maintains this is the best of all possible worlds, and Martin, who gets as close as possible, and we would see later in German philosophy in 100 years, people who go even farther, that this is somewhere near to the worst of all possible worlds, a sort of deep philosophical pessimism. And Candide sides a little bit closer to Martin, but he realizes that Martin, I mean, were he thorough and thinking that, as some pessimist philosophers like Schopenhauer have claimed, non-existence is better morally and rationally than existence, that he then wouldn't exist. But he persists in living. So there must be something to do. And so that thing becomes famously cultivating one's garden, right? But not to the point of wearing oneself out, as Cacambo had done. So there are betters and worses in life, but a sort of Aristotelian middle we're back to. So in a strange way, we're almost right back to where some of Middlemarch left us, which is a world of finding happy middles and golden means.
Yeah, Carl, I think those are great points. I definitely agree with you. One thing I really like about the ending is that sense of balance that we've achieved once more, because it's easy when Martin comes in 2/3 of the way through the book. He's clearly this anti-Panglossian character, and it would be tempting to sort of view the shift as Candide going all the way, and okay, now he's got a new master, and it's Martin, right? Guess what? Everything is pessimism, right? And he even calls himself a Manichaean at one point, suggesting that there's an evil demiurge out there who's like making the world a worse place. But that's not where Candide ends up. He ends up, you're absolutely right, somewhere in the middle of those two. And I liked your additional point about not wearing himself out with labor, working, but not too hard. Those are all great, great things. Could you lead us a little bit deeper into the world of the philosophy of this novel? And to do that, I wanted to bring back one of our favorite segments here on the Reader's Cares, which is Carl's Corner, where Carl takes some difficult philosophical concepts and really breaks them down for us and helps them understand the concepts a little bit better. And you're going to do that, I think, today with a little bit about the philosophy of Leibniz, who's hanging over this book in so many ways. And I think I hear the Carl's Corner music playing.
Okay, so Candide by Voltaire. Voltaire takes himself to be an eminent philosopher, and in many ways he's trying to take down the Leibnizian system. But Leibniz is no small player in the world of philosophy at this time. He's a big deal, and his philosophical system is very difficult and very perplexing. If you want to be extremely perplexed, take an hour and read The Monadology, Principles of Philosophy. Simple statements on their own might take many, many hours to try and synthesize this system or understand what it meant, even for Leibniz, to live in a world where the atoms of existence are what he calls monads. And Leibniz was interested in metaphysics as someone who thought that of the branches of philosophy, first among them must be logic. And so he believes in what some meta-philosophers call a first philosophy, and that is, for him, logic. Logic is the king of the branches of philosophy. And so if God exists, as God must for Leibniz, and we have this created thought that Leibniz came up with, an idea of possible worlds that could have been years and years before the multiple worlds interpretation of physics, then God, who is a perfect being and the best logically possible being, who therefore must have the most good in his created world, that world must be then the best of all these possible worlds. A lot of philosophers have quibbled with how is this possible? And there's a philosopher at Indiana, Tim O'Connor, who adds an interesting turn in this argument about the best of all possible worlds to infinity. And perhaps the best possible being who is God must create an infinite number of best possible worlds, in which case it would be a lot easier to get around this really only quibble that the book makes on philosophical grounds against this idea that we aren't in the best of all possible worlds, which is, what about evil? What about how the world looks to us? And the way Leibniz answers that, and the way Voltaire thinks he has taken that answer down, is around this notion of arguments of non-disconfirmability. So arguments of non-disconfirmability are ones where our own ignorance is baked into the objection. So you cannot simply say, I don't get it, it must be bad, it must not be correct. And so Leibniz is very smart, and so he understands that this is how a lot of people are often tricked, right? If you say, no, this conspiracy theory is true, well, how come there's not that much evidence? Well, the government's covered up all the evidence, don't you see? That's an argument that's hard to disconfirm, right? Our grounds for disconfirming it keep getting taken out from under us. And, you know, if you weren't born yesterday, you're well on your way to thinking, this is a trick, I don't get it. That doesn't mean that, you know, you're right, I've been tricked once or twice. And those are the same kind of grounds that Voltaire perhaps is accusing Leibniz of when he makes an argument for the best possible world. So really, he's kind of moving the goalpost from philosophy to psychology and saying, psychologically, this doesn't sit well with us. But where the tension is for Leibniz is to say, we are but an atom in the ocean of existence and time. And so what looks exceedingly terrible to us, we don't even know how small of a portion that is in the totality, in the whole. And so there's an irony to my argument of non-disconfirmability in that we don't really know how much we don't know at this moment. And so your attempt to turn me on your, like, on my head, I've turned you on your head. And so that's, I think, Leibniz's sly answer to that objection to his system, which doesn't show up in the book and I think is worth mentioning.
Thanks so much, Carl. Another great episode of Carl's Corner. And that brings home what's one of the interesting things about the book to me, which is that I do think that, and I might be biased because I had one of my professors as a philosophy undergraduate was an expert in Leibniz and he hated this book. but, you know, a bias against this book in terms of, is it actually doing actual philosophy? Is it meeting Leibniz on the ground that he should be met effectively on a logical ground? I think probably not. But I like the way you phrase this as a shift sort of from philosophy to psychology, to thinking it's great to sort of think in these huge totalistic systems and ways of thought that are based on logic and reason. And of course, reason itself, the principle of sufficient reason, which is a big deal for Leibniz, comes under attack in this book as well. But what Voltaire wants to point out is, like, this isn't how we live our lives, right? It doesn't do us any good to say, to sort of chant, this is the best of all possible worlds, when our wonderful, you know, would-be wife is getting beat up by Bulgarians and all these people are losing their homes and they're getting, you know, maimed and hanged and all this stuff. There's a real problem of evil at work in the world that abstraction can maybe answer on one level, but and then on another level gives us a not very satisfying answer. So I think that's an interesting way to look at it. This is sort of a psychological approach to some pretty difficult philosophical concepts. And whether or not Voltaire actually answers those effectively, gives objections to Leibniz's system, he's giving a pretty emotionally effective argument.
Yeah, well, the first time I read the book, I also was under the aegis of a Leibnizian. And I thought, this book is silly. This is not a good argument against Leibniz. But then on further reads, I thought, well, it's not. I don't think it's really trying to be, because Pangloss is still there at the end. And according to Voltaire, he's still arguing for his system at the end. And so I think Voltaire understands that it's a non-disconfirmable belief system. And I think the motion to psychology is one he's kind of saying, I'm willing to meet you halfway, even, Leibnizians. I'm just, we can hang out and debate it, because there will probably be no end to it. But while we're hanging out, we need to figure out what we can do to content ourselves and to cultivate ourselves.
Yeah.
And your system hasn't really, in its, you know, logical understanding of what monads are and the best possible world is and the principle of sufficient reason and determinism, that whole system doesn't help us with Voltaire's understanding of philosophy, which is more of the Seneca and how does one live the good life now. It doesn't quite touch down on those ideas for him. So there, he's, I think, kind of trying to meet him somewhere in Constantinople, you know, so.
Yeah, when they're in Constantinople and they're cultivating literally their farm, Candide, Martin, and Pangloss debate their dissertations and they have their disputes, and this is what's bringing them pleasure, is the fact that they have something to debate and talk about. And then when they run out of things to talk about, the old woman's like, I want to know what's worse, to be ravished by these people, have a buttock cut off, to run the gauntlet among the Bulgarians, blah, 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 have to go through an auto da fe, to go through all these miseries, or to stay home and have nothing to do. And then Candide's like, oh, yeah, that's a difficult question. And then they debate that, and it brings them some pleasure again. There's something...
And that's a direct reference, sorry, that's a direct reference to, like, the Leibnizian idea that the best of all possible worlds is like a painting which requires shadows.
Ooh, yeah.
And so that's why evil is necessary in the even in the best of all possible worlds, right? He's saying you want to look at the painting that's interesting,
yeah,
even, you know, not just the color field. Sorry to the minimalist color field artists of the late 20th century.
There's something that I appreciate about Voltaire's. He's asking, like, the best possible world for whom? Like, who can you identify in this novel, or whatever you want to call this picaresque, for whom it is the best possible world? And I love that Pangloss's answers always have to, like, reason backwards from the situation they're in to say, like, well, if we hadn't been, you know, captured by the Bulgarians and nearly killed and then sent to the New World and beaten and robbed and et cetera, we wouldn't have made it to this patch of land where we are now debating this. And wouldn't that be, you know, a tragedy or something like that? Just sort of justifying everything after the fact. But there is something truistic in Voltaire's point in this, something sort of, what's the word you might use, like a truism, like it kind of reduces things to, like, well, we can all cultivate each other and we can all cultivate our spot of land, and isn't that enough? And to me, that's a little, like, unsatisfying. But at the same time, if we're thinking about arguments, there might be counter arguments, but if we're thinking about, like, living a good life, which is a question he's not necessarily interested in the classical Greek sense of the question, but living a good life, living on your land and talking with your friends about philosophy and growing some food and becoming a good baker, that doesn't sound so bad. And so there's something about that I appreciate.
Carl, you're making your previous point, this is tied into what Friedrich just said as well, but you're making me wonder here, is this a Stoic book? Mm. Is this a book that's, like, about Stoicism as a way of life? Like, And I was thinking about that with regard to Friedrich's point, because it seems like ultimately the moral that Voltaire wants to get across is have enough, but don't have too much, right? Of either the good or the bad. Or maybe that's more like Epicurean almost, right? In some ways. But it's, you know, he admires Candide at the end. He admires this guy he meets. He thinks he must be, like, some awesome dude. And he's like, no, I just live at on my farm with my family. I get enough, you know, I produce enough food, I sell some of it. I've got enough to go on. And there's a running theme through the book of, like, excess versus generosity on the other side. And that's maybe one of Candide's great strengths as a character, is that he is generous with what he has. And he ends up giving all of his wealth that he's acquired away in order to help gather his friends together again. And so there's a sense of the excesses are not satisfying, in part because they might disappear, but if we're content with enough, then we have what will keep us going through life.
Epicurus, I think, is a great reference. I think it's the Tetrapharmakos or the Tetrapharmakon, the fourfold cure. Mm. Do not fear God. Do not fear death. What is good is easily obtained. What is bad is easily avoided. That's a different kind of middle, but it's, you know, it resonates. And though the Stoics didn't like Epicurus, I mean, in the longer view of history, they're very similar. So, like, it was like a narcissism of small differences of its day. Like, they're extremely similar. So, I think that makes total sense for the ending, where Candide is in between, you know, a deep pessimism and a wide-eyed optimism, according to Voltaire. So, yeah, I like that reference. And the Stoic ataraxia, right, is another middle where one is just trying to be equidistant from all emotional responses to a situation, never pulled or mastered or whipped into an emotion, but able to choose it if one wants or not. I like that ending, and I like it looking at philosophy in that way. Maybe then I guess it isn't so much psychology. It's like a psychologized philosophy, like the late Wittgenstein.
Thinking about deriving pleasure from things reminds me of one of, I think, all of our favorite characters in this book. He's only there for one chapter, but is really very memorable. And it's a man named Pococurante. And he's somebody that Candide encounters when he's in Italy. And he's a guy who's sort of praised to Candide as somebody who's got it all. And so Candide goes to Pococurante's house and he sees all this amazing stuff he has. And Pococurante's response to everything is, meh. Right? It's like, I've got these two beautiful serving girls here, and yeah, I sleep with them because I'm tired of everybody else I slept with, but I'm going to be tired of them soon too. It's like, oh, you got these wonderful editions of Homer. He's like, meh. I mean, I used to like Homer, but then I realized he was just kind of an idiot. And it's like everything he goes through, all this artwork, he's got Raphaels in his house, he's got these beautiful gardens, and everything is just this source of non-committal, you know, no joy in them at all, and all these wonderful things. I'm wondering what you all think about Pococurante's place in this novel.
Things had to be blasé because they are, after all, the mest of possible worlds.
Oh. Friedrich, what do you make? I mean, what do you like about Pococurante? What do you make of him and his place?
Turn
in this
away
book?
From Carl with that.
Carl, Carl's joke I'm letting is it so hang. Bad.
No, I'm letting
we
it.
We just
hang.
Have to move on.
I was letting it land.
Like a weird fart that no one wants to acknowledge.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was a good joke.
It is good. The thing I like about Pococurante is that he's a recognizable type, even today. If you go to graduate school in the humanities, you might come across Pococurantes aplenty. And who we agree are above everything they possess. You know, they read something and they say, this person's an idiot for thinking that. You read something else, they say, this person gets this all wrong. They read the literature of their period and they say, I kind of hate all of this. And there's just sort of a casual dismissal of the best that has been thought and said. I mean, I'm not trying to, that's maybe a hot take.
Taking down the town right now, Friedrich.
For that reason alone, I appreciate Pococurante's presence. But it's a nice, I haven't thought too deeply about him, but he's a nice presence in the novel because he's, you know, we've approached people who have had and then lost, or have gained and then lost and gained, and have turned on the wheel of fortune. And then you have the nobleman who has it all. And Voltaire seems to be presenting us with someone who finds no joy in this stuff, regardless of gain or loss. It's just like, this isn't even necessarily having to do with the material. It has to do with like your cultivated self or with attitudes. And as much as optimism might be skewered in this, as much as thinking all the best might be laughed at, there's also a sense that you still need to engage and you still need, you know, take the pleasure where you can get it. And so for that reason, I like this chapter.
What I really like about Pococurante is the discussion between Candide and Martin about him at the end of this chapter. So it seems that nothing can please him, Candide is saying. Well, now that you must agree that this was the happiest of all men, for he is superior to everything he possesses, as Friedrich was saying. And Martin is saying, don't you see he's disgusted with everything he possesses? And Candide thinks, isn't there pleasure in criticizing everything, in seeing faults where other people think they see beauties? Just hating, you know, just a hater. And Martin, this is what makes it so funny to me, who's, you know, the deep pessimist, is almost like saying, that's too much for me, man. He's like, but that is to say that there's pleasure in having no pleasure. And I think there Voltaire makes a really smart point about, like, the nature of pleasure. And it's kind of a Kierkegaardian point about crop rotation. There's something more perennial, weirdly, in a person who is pleased by hating everything, to stick in that mode of always hating, than there is in the person who, you know, loves one particular, like, meal or something and then has it every day. That person's going to end up hating it, you know, eventually, is kind of Voltaire's point. And so better to kind of start out on the route of just hating everything. But again, it's not a viable way to cultivate at the end, right? So I think that's why we drop him.
And I think it's interesting that he's maybe too much of a, as you kind of pointed out before, he's like too much of a pessimist even for Martin.
Yeah.
And Martin really is a fascinating character to me because he is so pessimistic in so many ways. And yet, to put it in the stupidest possible way, the one thing he hasn't given up on is friendship, right? He's still, like, he hates the world, he hates everything in it, but he doesn't commit suicide, right? Which would be maybe the logical way out. And he's committed to Candide in some ways. Mm-hmm. And so he's clearly, I mean, my point there is that he's committed to the pleasure of disputation in some way. He does derive pleasure from his kind of endless quibbles with Pangloss and Candide at the end. And so there's something there motivating him versus Pococurante, who just doesn't have anything going on at all. All he has is disgust and pessimism for what's going on.
Yeah, it's like the difference between going somewhere just to try and hate on something or shut it down and, you know, tell people how you feel about it who you don't care about, versus like you want to meet up with your friends because you disagree with them and you enjoy the disagreement and you enjoy the interchanging of ideas, exchanging of ideas.
As much as in the picaresque here that we have in front of us, people are allied with sort of types, would either of you say then that this is, like, despite that, a novel in which, despite their philosophical outlooks, people aren't, like, married to them as far as, like, guiding the way they live their life? Like, Soren, you're just pointing out that Martin still holds on to friendship and he still loves to debate with these people and he doesn't commit suicide, that for Voltaire, the philosophical outlook one maintains doesn't necessarily guide the way they live their life.
I think that's absolutely true, Friedrich. You can see it in a couple of different ways. One, this is an interesting point that I picked up on in this reading. By the end of the novel, you're absolutely right, Carl, that Pangloss is still repeating his old maxims, but Voltaire goes out of the way to say to us, he keeps saying these things even though he no longer believes them, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Which is interesting. Like, he can't let go of the point because he's a professional philosopher. but you also see it in the way, you know, this is the other big target of the book, is religious practice and how out of line the practice is with what the stated beliefs might be. And you get that in many different ways. He loves to take shots, especially at the Jesuits, but also different groups of friars,
right,
and Protestants as well. I mean, Voltaire is writing in a heavily Catholic country and he's primarily attacking the Catholic Church, but he also attacks Protestants, right? There's a wonderful scene early on in the book where Candide finally shows up in the Netherlands and he's like desperately hungry. He needs a place to stay. And this guy's like, hey, do you think the Pope's the Antichrist? And he's like, I don't know. And then his wife's like, he doesn't think the Pope's the Antichrist. And she like dumps the chamber pot on his head. Right. And the only person at that point in the book who helps him is this Anabaptist character who then very cruelly dies by falling overboard a ship. And Pangloss, who's with Candide at that point, is like, well, we could go rescue him, but he's just an Anabaptist. Yeah. Right. And so there's a theme, right? I mean, it's a pretty obvious point, and he really hammers it, right? Which is that, like, oftentimes religious people are hypocrites.
Yeah.
Right? But there's I do think the broader point there is well taken, which is that the ideals that somebody holds to and says that they claim are not necessarily what's going to guide their life. And even Candide, you know, to an extent, part of what saves him throughout is that even though, I mean, he turns into a more critical appreciator of Pangloss's ideas about the world. And so he becomes a little bit more canny as the book goes along and is able to, even as he's still, by the end, he's abandoned Pangloss's ideas, at least somewhat. But even in the middle of the book, when he says he's still holding them, he's sort of reacting in these other ways now. He's gained more experience. And so, yeah, I think there is a point there that the way that we say we see the world doesn't necessarily line up with how we are in the world.
So my second question following that would be, is this a book that's anti-philosophical or against philosophy in any way? Or is that taking it a bridge too far?
I mean, it depends on what you mean by anti-philosophy. That's like a, that's in itself a term. Alain Badiou uses that term to describe like Wittgenstein, who said, you know, his goal is like someone who's out to, like, he's like a low-level politician out to evict, to get the slumlords out of his city. That's what he, that's how he thinks of philosophers. The goal of philosophy is to eliminate bad philosophies. That's kind of what an anti-philosopher is for Badiou. I don't think that Voltaire is such a person. I think, you know, he's reorienting philosophy along his lines, secular humanist, a world where there's optimism, but there's clearly evil, and there's no obvious system for how history is going to work out, or any obvious sort of determinism that denies free will and makes us look at, you know, a principle of sufficient reason as if we were looking at like a astrology chart for what the next week is going to look like, right? He's against that kind of way of thinking about the world, but still for philosophical way of looking at the world, I think.
In some sense, Friedrich, though I do agree with Carl that I don't think this is necessarily an anti-philosophy work, I think you might be onto something in some sense, because I'm thinking about one of the centerpieces of the book is Candide's gone to South America. He's lost Cunegonde again. He's killed Cunegonde's brother on accident, as happens, although he comes back later, right? He's escaped into the jungle with Cacambo, and then they end up stumbling on the civilization of El Dorado. And this forms one of the kind of interesting hinge points at the of the book. And what he finds out is that the people of El Dorado live in this kingdom. They treat gold like dirt. It's just all over the place. It's so when they leave, they take a bunch of sheep with them that are just laden with gold and their fleece and diamonds and things like that. And it's just worthless to all these people. But everybody has plenty. They go to this village and it looks like a resort town, and they have this feast and everybody's apologizing because they're like, "Oh, sorry, we're like a really poor village. You're not being fed very well. But go to the capital and you'll be great," right? But the idea is that like everybody has all of their wants provided for. There's no doesn't really seem to be like any need. Everybody has things provided, and there's no religion, or they have a religion, but it's like everybody's a priest. Everybody says things of Thanksgiving, and they don't pray because they don't have any needs anymore. And so there's a sort of stasis that's been achieved through a sort of what we may call, like, it's not fully automated, but like luxury communism, right? It's like this idea of equal provision to an excess degree. But then at the same time, that's only possible in El Dorado because they've basically sealed off all the exits. Nobody can – they only get in by accident. You're not supposed to be able to get into it. And you can't leave. No one's allowed to leave, right? The actual citizens. They let Candide out because he's not a citizen. But every citizen of El Dorado has to remain in place because they don't want to get tainted by the outside world. And in many ways, it's easy to read this El Dorado, and I think in some ways it is, as a sort of like rebuke to the European powers of the time, of this sort of like dream, almost like a Rousseauian dream of – a sort of noble innocence among a people who haven't been tainted by Western society. But at the same time, it's also kind of a chilling vision, right, of stasis, right? It's mirrored somewhat by the end, but it's even like a less content than the end is, because there's just nothing really to do in El Dorado, right? And so I wonder if he's kind of trying to in some ways suggest a tension between the philosophical and the material or the economic that he doesn't really fully resolve, but he's at least sees the advantage in sort of the economic provision that leads to a society without philosophers. But again, I don't think he's fully on board with that either.
It's an interesting point about the sort of unspoken economic background of this piece of writing, in which like the people who have everything and have closed them, I mean, naturally been closed off from the world, are sort of like not quite the Eloy of the time machine, but approaching that, that they, why would they think about other religions? They don't have other religions. They have the one religion. Why would they think about developing anything else? They have everything. And yet they have these like really capable mathematicians, 3,000 of them come together to design this machine to lift them over the mountains. And so they're a weirdly capable society, but what are they doing? They're a utopia, and as people have written, utopias can be really boring. and so to what use is that knowledge put, or to what is that? Maybe there's a question there about use and the value of thinking about use. But certainly I think you're right that the juxtaposition of this is the farm outside Constantinople at the end, where the pleasure is in learning new things and debating old things and developing oneself. And in that place, it certainly seems like there's no ability to develop oneself because things are developed. And what do you do with that?
It's kind of like the Futurama episode where Professor Farnsworth and some other scientists figured out everything. And so there's nothing left for the scientists to do anymore. And they get really bored and really sad. And they sit around with their test tubes and their instruments, and they've got nothing to investigate. And then they spend years and years and years trying to come up with a problem that they can investigate because they're so desperate to do stuff. It's like the sad retiree life where they got nothing to do. And so I think maybe that's the point that Soren's getting towards. It's one of those weird moments in this novel too that you can appreciate at a distance, obviously, where Voltaire's trying to say something against how European society is running.
Yeah.
Even though he's doing it in like ways we find today to be racist and sexist. But there's an attempt to say, hey, there are other societies out there, and our society has got a lot of deep problems. And Candide, the main character, is one of those things too, right? He's like your go-getter European. He's gonna go to another country and give them the good news. Turns out he's not good at it. It's terrible. It's a failure. He's gonna be really smart and figure out all of these things, and he can't figure out anything. And he just kind of like has a few books that he's liked, and he really liked Pangloss, his like teacher, and you know, that guy is kind of a fraud and a failure, and he doesn't amount to much. And Candide, you know, is where it's the root of like Candid and White and political candidate, even, right? Mm. It's supposed to be the like capable unit in a European society that changes things for the better, and he can't do that. So Voltaire is trying to attack his own society's view of the world in some way as well.
I think what's interesting about this as a depiction of other societies and other worlds, you could say, that is being visited by a sort of ignorant European in some senses, is maybe revealed by comparing it to another near contemporary, Swift and Gulliver's Travels, in which Gulliver goes to all of these places, and then every time he returns to England is like, my God, these people are ugly. My God, my family is full of idiots. And my God, this is the worst of all possible places to live in the world. Like, he just like learns about like better places and then finds his own life horrifying. And Candide doesn't do that. I think maybe the difference I'm trying to draw out is that for Voltaire, running into those societies, it doesn't necessarily produce knowledge about like a new place than compared to Europe. Although that's there, it produces like an idea about, as we've been talking about this whole podcast, like a different way of thinking about finance or wealth, or a different way of thinking about freedom, I guess, or enlightenment ideals. And it's like approaching different ways of thinking as represented in other societies, if that makes some sense to you too.
I wanted to point us maybe in one more direction before we wrap up. And that's thinking about the place of humor in the philosophical work of this book. Mm. Because I think even today, it's kind of remarkable how it holds up. Like, I think it's a very funny book in a lot of ways. Some of the stuff, you know, it's a little bit dated in terms of what we do and don't laugh at these days, obviously. And there's, you know, some stereotyping and things like that. But some of it is still, I find it to be tremendously funny. The account of how Pangloss gets syphilis, that's like traceable back through all of these different people. I'm sorry, maybe this is like a cancelable offense, but I find the old woman having lost a buttock, extremely funny. And she like can never ride horse. She's always talking about how she can't ride horses because she can't balance on them.
And comically managed, where she mentions her buttock a couple of times before it's disclosed why she lost her buttock in a house.
Exactly. Yes. It's a cliffhanger there. Yeah.
It's great in our translation. Obviously, we're all reading it in English, where it's just buttock. Yes. It's just a funny word.
Yes. Yes.
The singular. Yes.
It's beautiful. So there's a lot of really, I find him to be very comic moments where he's also trying to press us to have thoughts about things. And I think that he wants us to laugh and then also to kind of process why he's doing things in a particular way. I'm thinking about one of my favorite scenes, which is Martin and Candide are setting sail. They're leaving France. And they accidentally like sail up to England, and they kind of look at what's going on in England, and they're like, "We don't even want to. No, let's not even go there. Let's just leave it alone." And so it's like so bad that they don't even want to touch it, which is great because Candide or Voltaire's just spent a bunch of time insulting the French, his own people, and then he's like, "No, no, no. The English are even. They're so bad we can't even like think about going there." Right. So there's these wonderful moments of humor where he's using the humor almost as a wedge to get us to think about particular situations and maybe give a second thought to things we wouldn't normally give a second thought to. And I'm wondering what you think about his uses of humor and how they might tie into those intellectual elements that Voltaire is going for.
I mean, it connects in the sort of logical form of the reductio ad absurdum. When we see five or six heads of state and then Candide's like, well, I have way more money than all of you guys. And Voltaire himself, I think, loaned out money to regents or heads of state. It's just like a, well, what the heck is the point of your title? Or, you know, you're really blowing it. It's kind of ridiculing the idea, getting us to laugh at the idea is, you could argue, one way to counter it logically. Again, first psychologically, and then it makes you wonder, well, what about that idea is worth standing so highly in our minds?
I think it's a form of humor recognizable to us today in that it's sort of tearing down ideals and tearing down national unities and things like that. I'll say what it reminds me of. It reminds me of Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose, in which there's a lost second book of poetics by Aristotle on comedy that's sort of like the thing they're pursuing and is people are dying because of. And there's something for Echo in the book about comedy that's going to unlock some sort of knowledge for these monks and investigators. And I feel like Voltaire's not giving us big answers here, but he's showing us that comedy has the power to like tear down certain damaging ideas in his mind and doing a lot of other things. But that, for my starting point about thinking, I'm looking to that. I'm looking to like the unknown second book of poetics and thinking about Umberto Eco.
There's so much to say about that.
There's a fascinating Umberto Eco book that very few people have read. I think one of his later novels called Baudolino, which is another medieval set book.
I want to read that, yeah.
It's really good. It's about the quest for the kingdom of Prester John.
Yeah, it looks so good.
In India. And it is sort of, now that I'm thinking about it, it is sort of a Candide-esque book where it's like sort of historically set, traverse through all these different lands, and it's very bodily comic, right, in the sort of things that they encounter, and there's these ends up being kind of like all these weird creatures that they encounter as they're going through. But it does have that sense of cutting through.
And maybe that's why I said truism earlier, because it's sort of like, it seems reductive, but it does cut through.
There's a bluntness to it.
Yeah.
That, again, maybe like we end up by saying, yeah, Voltaire is like not the most subtle critic of things. Like, but even so, there's an effectiveness to what he's doing.
Yeah.
I mean, the ending is very classic, and I was impressed by it the first time I read it. I guess now it's become a bit of a cliche, but maybe some of our listeners are thinking about it for the first time. And to me, it remains powerful, even though maybe because it's a book of so many comedic moments, one after the other, that I take it to be like a straight answer to the problems of the book. And it reminds me sort of, in a weird way, of Viktor Frankl. Famously survived concentration camps, and what is man's search for meaning? Where does it end? How does one persist and endure? And deal with the problem of evil, and it's that the meaning must be made, right? It must be cultivated. One must have a will to meaning. And I think Voltaire is gesturing towards that in some ways at the end by saying there are these three vices, boredom, poverty, and or just vice itself, and cultivation can kill those things. And that's where the will to meaning emerges. I still like that. I don't know. That's part of why I picked it. It's as with the Stoics, it's a book to read, to laugh with, and then also to feel some sort of stealing of one's will towards, you know, going back out and creating as well as finding meaning.
Frankl wrote this is a quotation. I usually don't keep quotables in my mind, but this is one that I always remember. Frankl wrote that between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and freedom. That seems to ring true with the ending of this book as it focuses on cultivation.
I definitely agree with you, Carl, that there's a certain power to this, the ending of this book. In a book that's been so dedicated to so many ridiculous things, and really in a book that I disagree with so much of what's going on. I disagree with so many of the philosophical principles on display and and the points he really wants to make about society. I do find the ending very powerful and very attractive, that we might find through a sort of embrace of cultivation and productivity a release from something of the badness of life. Well, we're gonna wrap up for now. Thank you all for joining us on this journey all around the world. We're going to be back next time with my first pick of the season, another book somewhat about totality, another sort of raucous comedy and a satire of philosophy. Again, maybe we'll see how effective that is as anti-philosophy. And that is the ancient Greek comedy, The Clouds by Aristophanes. We're headed to the thinkery, my friends, and we hope you'll join us next time. But until then, we're going to let Cat Keyboard play us out.
Oh, those Russians. Welcome to Postmodern Food Factory.
Welcome, listeners, to the inaugural episode of Postmodern Food Factory, a little bonus content for you faithful Readers K listeners out there. We can maybe think of this as the Eater's Karamazov. Postmodern Food Factory is a segment of the show where the three of us find the most disgusting stuff we can to eat that represents our modern moment. And Carl has dug up a doozy for us of this first go-around. So, Carl, do you want to tell us what's on the docket for tonight?
A doozy indeed. Proof that even for Carl Bookmarks, advertising still works sometimes. The glorious and strange, trippy and surreal John Cena Super Bowl advertisement for a new flavor of Mountain Dew hit something deep within me that the algorithm had clearly figured out. And so today we will be trying the, I believe, newest Mountain Dew flavor, though Soren has showed me that there are many deep secret Mountain Dew flavors that I hadn't
beneath the mountains
known of. And that is Mountain Dew Major Melon.
All right, boys. So we each have our own delightful bottle of Major Melon in front of us. What are you seeing as you look at this glorious artifact?
I'm interested in the target audience, which is kind of me.
Yeah, this has a real skater vibe going on.
It does have a real skater vibe. Like
sort of Sega Genesis era artwork.
Major Melon looks like he is riding on a skateboard that is a melon, which is kind of a disturbing image.
Major Melon is like kind of cool looking, but then if you look at him for like one full minute, you become sort of absorbed with how bizarre he is and how he would function as a major in the Melon Army.
Does he like have battle damage? Are those like cuts in him revealing those pink?
Yes. Wow. Because he's hardcore. Does he look a little bit like
a slice of melon in his helmet?
Yes.
He's carrying like a pencil or something.
Does he look a little bit like the Pokemon Gengar to you?
Ooh, yeah.
A little bit of a Gengar vibe there.
Yeah, that grim.
I like the like horror version of the watermelon on the top.
Yes. Like Seymour from Little Shop of Horrors type.
They're appealing to the drama kids as well as the skater kids. So that's nice.
I'm also getting the like original Jurassic Park kind of vibes from it. I don't know why.
Oh, yeah. I see that. You're right, Friedrich. I like this comment. It is very, very Sega Genesis-y here. So
it's like the artwork for like an Earthworm Jim or a Toe Jam and Earl.
Ooh, Earthworm Jim. Well, that's an awesome deep cut.
Do you play Toe Jam and Earl, Carl? All
right. Toe Jam and Earl. That's another that deep cut.
Okay.
I thought, I was under the impression, because I saw the commercial when you sent it to us, I was under the impression that John Cena was going to be on the label as like some part of the marketing. No,
I mean,
John Cena
is.
Is this John Cena in his watermelon form?
Yes. Below the watermelon, you can't see it in the picture. He's wearing jorts.
Okay. Oh, this is delightful. Well,
John Seedless. That was
John Seedless.
Oh, wow. You know, I've seen a few doozies in my day, but that was a big one.
I just want to note for the listeners at home who don't have this in front of them that this is, in fact, dew charged with watermelon.
I also want to notice. I also want
and
to
other
note
natural flavors.
Some sweet nutrition facts, and we all have. I think this is the only version of it left because they didn't do canned version. I don't think we have a 16.9 ounce bottle. Which is another strange hybrid in bottle sizing.
It's a nice, comfortable 500 milliliters. It must have been for the European market.
It's the European, the That's sophisticated true. European palates.
It contains 0% juice. It's 230 calories. It has 62 grams of total sugar. If you're keeping track at home, that's 123% of your daily value of sugar.
I like that it specifies, it says total sugars, 62 grams, includes 62 grams added sugars.
And 77 milligrams of caffeine.
This is delightful.
Oh my goodness.
All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and open my bottle. I'm going to do it so the listeners can hear this. Oh, the refreshing sound. Yeah. I can smell it already. It's already releasing the smell like into the room.
Watermelon Jolly Rancher. Ooh, actually, no, like Kool-Aid.
Watermelon Kool-Aid. It does smell like Kool-Aid. It smells like Kool-Aid.
It smells like Kool-Aid for sure.
It has that sort of like weird weakness that Kool-Aid has.
Yeah.
Where there's like some flavor and then it just immediately dissipates into
just
water.
It all depends on the sweetness of the sugar and that's it.
Okay.
Oh my goodness.
I'm pouring mine. I've got a glass of ice here, so I'm going to pour mine over ice.
Let's hear that.
The rocks to get the full experience.
Soren is so legit. I'm down in it, baby.
Okay, so it's pouring a little bit lighter than it looks in the bottle.
Yeah. That does look more like Kool-Aid or like a pink lemonade. Yeah.
Also, for listeners, it is bright pink. I would say neon highlighter pink.
Yeah. It's looking good. It's looking good. It's got a little bit of a rosé touch to it.
Carl and I are going straight out of the bottle, yeah.
Okay, good. All right, let's do it. Three, two, one.
Cheers, y'all. It tastes like watermelon fruit by the foot. Was that what it was?
Oh, yeah. Well, that had the seeds.
For those millennials out there.
Yeah.
Or like watermelon Laffy Taffy
in
soda form. I'm a fan. I approve. I'm glad I picked it.
I'm not sure what's going on here.
It definitely has that flavor of like, you know, there's like a somewhere in like a German laboratory, there's like the eight different like fruit flavors that they use for every single candy that they've just like fruit scientists developed. This has that watermelon flavor that's straight from the lab.
I love those flavors. I love what, like, fake strawberry 3, whatever it is, that's in, like, all strawberry-flavored candy.
Do you know the experience when you're eating a Jolly Rancher, which I've not done for many years, and you get to the end, and it's, like, super thin, like stained glass almost. Yes. And then you like kind of try to like chew it in your mouth a little bit. That's what this flavor reminds me of. Like it's like That's watermelon, beautiful. But it's then stretched out.
Fruit for by the foot, list- thin Jolly Rancher. There's a stretch quality going on here.
For our listeners, Soren is taking tentative sips and making perplexed faces.
I've not done the swish and spit
whereas
yet,
Friedrich and I are, I would say, safely gulping some down.
Oh, yeah. We're more of the two dew heads out of this group here.
Yeah, so I need your expert opinion on this. Are you getting... Would you describe this as dew charged with watermelon? Because it's been a while since I've had the original Mountain Dew, but I'm not getting a whole lot of dew flavor here.
I get no dew flavor.
The dew is at the end. There's just a little bit of that classic dew taste at the end.
That feel, yeah.
But it is like, it's like an infused vodka or something almost, where like
yeah.
The original vodka taste is like not, you know,
oh.
It's the background. It's not there to... Be the main character.
Soren's, are you going for the whole bottle?
I guess so. Why not, right? Live a little. I may not drink the whole thing, but I'm pouring it out because it's not going to come to any other use. I'm refusing to let my children touch this. I may go give it to my students tomorrow. The rest of my six pack. These only come in, well, I did actually see cans at my store, but
okay.
Really?
They don't come in. It was a 12 pack. They don't come in singles. Ooh. They don't come in.
Oh, that would be sweet.
You got to find a LAN party and drop it off.
I want to know what the can art is compared to the bottle art.
Ooh, yeah.
Me too. It's a good question. Carl, you are a resident dew expert with Friedrich maybe coming in second and I'm a distant third. But would you, we'll put this in the show notes for this because it's an art object unlike any other. We've got pulled up the Wikipedia page, list of Mountain Dew flavors and varieties. And how many would you estimate there are on here, Friedrich? What do you think? There's got to be 30, no, 40, 50.
I would say 40 or more.
40 or more.
Some of these are enumerated, yeah.
There's at least 20 on the current flavors, and there's a whole batch of...
Discontinued.
Batch of discontinued, yeah. So we're not going to count those. We won't count the international variations. But there's an India only version of Mountain Dew Game Fuel apparently. But Carl, would you just take us through and tell us how many of these you've had?
Okay, there are a lot more than I thought. Turns out I'm an apprentice enthusiast of Mountain Dew. I thought there were maybe like 30, of which I'd had like 20. But yeah, there's so many. So not counting diets or caffeine frees. I've had the Mountain Dew with the old school sugar kind, the throwback original kind, and the obviously high fructose corn syrup kind, including, remember when they had the like big gulp can opening?
Yeah.
The wider wide opening.
Mouth.
Yeah. Yeah. Wide yeah. mouth.
I do remember the wide mouth. Oh my gosh. You're taking me back here.
I had... once at a band concert before I was of adult age, I had two of those right in a row and hadn't drank anything else or ate anything else before in the whole day. I'm surprised I survived and didn't like pass out.
Wait, what instrument were you playing?
I was just like jamming and like moshing with my friends.
Oh, okay.
Mountain Dew Code Red, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
The standard offshoot. Mountain Dew Live Wire. Mountain Dew Pitch Black, had the Mountain Dew Baja Blast.
You describe Pitch Black as maybe the worst one, right?
It just was really disappointing. I think I was the most disappointed by that one.
A grape variant. That doesn't sound promising.
Yeah, it was bad. Just the grapeness didn't work for me. Mountain Dew Game Fuel.
Classic.
Yeah, it's another popular one.
Yeah.
Mountain Dew Voltage. Definitely had that.
With ginseng. Wow.
Oh, yeah. They're throwing everything in there. Mountain Dew Whiteout. Another really bad one. I was saying before we aired, I don't know if I've had Electric Apple or not.
This was, listeners, Electric Apple was an apple variant introduced exclusively at Villa Pizza. I have no idea what that is, but.
Yeah, neither do I.
No idea.
That's why I don't think I've had it.
Pizza chain, looks like. Yeah.
The 7-Eleven slash ones that were at convenience stores more widely, I feel like I've had most of those. Mountain Dew Solar Flare, Mountain Dew Berry Monsoon.
Mm.
And then at this point, I don't think I've had tons of the other ones.
For listeners, we are not even halfway through this list. So
not even.
You can now check off, however, Major Melon from that list.
Absolutely.
Have you had Voodoo?
That's the one I really want to have.
The mystery flavor was described as fruit candy explosion.
It was revealed to be candy corn.
Uh-huh.
Oh my goodness, I want that. That one's probably the most like natural. That one's for like those health nuts out there because of the high fructose corn syrup is like, and the candy corn, you know, it's, mm-hmm. it's back to its natural roots. It's a real natural drink.
Oh my goodness.
And just in the current flavors that exist, if you scroll down, you hit Mountain Dew Major Melon and Major Melon Zero Sugar, and there are, which says 2021 to present, and there are still four flavors after that.
What?
Baja Punch, Baja Flash, Goji Citrus Strawberry, and Cake Smash.
Oh my goodness. Well, this is a wonderful world that we have stumbled into. Thank you, Carl, for
being
our guide.
We're
going to
be doing
this for
weeks now. they got Riddler's Brew coming up in 2022. Yes. That's the owl.
Riddler's Brew.
Hard Mountain Dew. An alcoholic line of flavors, including original black cherry and watermelon.
Oh, yeah. Major Melon. Gonna get spiked. That's beautiful. Well, before we go and disband this episode of Postmodern Food Factory, why don't we give our thoughts overall, some sort of rating? We can make up our own rating system as we go here. Friedrich, what are you giving Mountain Dew Major Melon?
I'm gonna taste it one more time, just so I don't want to be
me too.
I want to make sure I'm being accurate with my assessment.
I'm gonna give it it's in the top tier of dews. I'm going to put it up there.
Wow.
With Livewire.
Ooh. Really? Livewire is my favorite by far.
I'm going to say that for dew variants, it does what it's there to do.
It does.
Pun intended. It's the watermelon. You want a watermelon Mountain Dew? This is it.
It delivers on its
a lot of watermelon promise. A lot of Mountain Dew.
It's Major Melon. I'm going to give it 3 copies of SSX Tricky out of 5.
Oh man.
Oh wow. Yeah. I don't know what to do. I mean, I didn't hate it. It smelled worse than it tasted.
Okay, I want to end by saying there are so many kinds of Mountain Dew that if the people who made this are listening and you could make a Reader's Karamazov Mountain Dew.
Yeah, please.
That would be the highest achievement of our lives.
I mean, I'm imagining inside of PepsiCo, it's just like that drill tweet where it's like budget. It's like $5,000 advertising, $20 million Mountain Dew R&D.
I really want to know the person who came up with the commercial and this logo and this flavor.
Oh, yeah.
That team. I bet you there are meetings and meetings and meetings about the new Major Melon dropping this Super Bowl.
Oh, man. Well, this has been delightful, friends. Do you all remember the old urban legend about Mountain Dew lowering your sperm count?
Oh, yeah. It was one of the coloring things. This one has red 40. I feel like it was a yellow. And I heard it was like different variations on it. One was like it makes your penis smaller. One is it lowers your sperm count. It was all have to do with, you know, your genitals.
Well, if this one does it to us, I think we've earned it. So, all right, that's gonna do it for us on this episode of Postmodern Food Factory. We'll be back next time with another disgusting thing to try. Till then, take it easy.
This has been another episode of Postmodern Food Factory.